we get, the more reasonable, you know, the proposals are looking, you know, the further the company moves away. It's a moving target. I don't think they want to reach an agreement.
Gladding says contract talks are stalled and wants the National Mediation Board to release it from negotiations with American. That means it could vote to strike in 30 days. But American says it's too soon to break off talks and progress is still being made. It also denies its stalling negotiations. For NPR News, I'm Bill Ziebel in Dallas.
A court in Pakistan is charging five Americans with plotting terror attacks in that country. Each man is from the Washington, D.C. area. They're facing possible life sentences if convicted. I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info.
Hi, this is Masumi Rostad of the Pacifica String Quartet. Please join WILL 40 North, Krannert, and me for the new Docha Chamber Music Festival. We are playing at Radio Maria, Cakes on Walnut, and Jim Gould's in downtown Champaign, April 1st to 3rd. Docha will feature great music from some of our town's finest musicians, including Stefan Milenkovich, Dmitry Kuzov, Rudolf Hawken, and my group, the Pacifica Quartet. Admission is free. For more information, visit docha.org.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by The Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, located in Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. This morning, in the first part of the program, we'll be going to the archives so we can bring you a show that we first broadcast in February. This is Conversation with Scott Sampson. He's a scientist who is very interested in dinosaurs, and it's a pretty cool and fun topic. So we talked about some of the things you'll find in his new book, Dinosaur Odyssey. That's hour number one. Hour number two, we will be talking live with Aaron Michel Kerjean from the Wharton School of Economics at University of Pennsylvania about risk and how it is we think about and manage risk on a very large scale. So that's hour number two. We will be taking calls in hour two, but during this first hour, do keep in mind as you listen to the show that this is an encore performance and we will not be taking calls. Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we will be spending some time talking about dinosaurs. Dinosaurs were the dominant large-bodied life form on land on this planet for over 150 million years. They were one of the most diverse and most successful groups of animals ever, and I think in the minds of many people, one of the most fascinating. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with Scott Sampson. He is a dinosaur paleontologist and evolutionary biologist. He is the author of a recently published book that is titled Dinosaur Odyssey, Fossil Threads in the Web of Life. The book has just come out recently, and it would be a book, I think, for people who are interested in dinosaurs, people of most ages. I think that you could find a lot of things in the book that are really fascinating about dinosaurs and their many different forms, and also about dinosaurs and how they fit into the ecosystem of their time. And perhaps in a larger sense about how they fit into the ecosystem of the Earth. And it certainly talks about some of the things that we have been learning about dinosaurs just recently, because one of the points we want to make is that maybe the last 25 years or so has been one of the most exciting periods in all of dinosaur paleontology. The book is published by the University of California Press, is out now, so I'm sure that you can seek it out in the bookstore. Let me just tell you a little bit more about our guest. After he got his PhD in zoology from University of Toronto, he spent a year working at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City. After that, spent a few years as assistant professor of anatomy at the New York College of Osteopathic Medicine on Long Island. And then from 1999 until 2000, held a dual position with the Utah Museum of Natural History and the Department of Geology and Geophysics at the University of Utah. In 2007, he moved to San Francisco, the San Francisco area, still had a a formal research affiliation with the University of Utah, but now he's working on a number of different projects that focus on education. He was the primary scientific consultant and on-air host of the four-part documentary Dinosaur Planet, which aired on the Discovery Channel. And right now he's serving in the same pair of roles for the PBS children's television series called Dinosaur Train, which is now, I'm told, the most popular kids' program on public television, you can see it, in fact, on our own station, WILL-TV. Check your local listings. I'm here looking at the program guide, and I see, yes, in fact, you can see this program on Sundays at 7:30. That's 7:30 in the morning. Questions, comments are certainly welcome as we talk with Scott Sampson. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, also toll-free. Good to anywhere that you can hear us. That number is 800-222-9455. You may also send your questions by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Scott Sampson, hello.
Hello there, David. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, well, thanks very much for talking with us. It's one of those topics that I think for a lot of people, no matter how old you are, is just something that has the endless power to fascinate. Was this something, were you bitten by the dinosaur bug when you were a kid?
Yeah, I'm afraid paleontology was one of the first words I learned how to spell, which means I was a geek from a young age probably, but my mother loves to tell stories about me looking for dinosaur books in the library at the age of five. But it's an interesting thing that dinosaurs are so popular generation after generation, and I'm often asked sort of why that is. And I don't know that we know for sure, but I think that some of the answers are that they're big, they're bizarre, and they're dead in the sense that they're gone now, and so they're kind of monsters that are safe to love. And kids get into them because it's a whole lot of different names that they can memorize and impress the adults around them with.
Yeah, and I guess that the what seems to be among the many interesting and remarkable things, this incredible diversity. I mean, as you say, we think of them as being big, and certainly there were dinosaurs that were big, but they're also the dinosaurs that were small. There were dinosaurs of all sort of shapes and sizes, and actually we really don't know what color they were, but, you know, sort of all shapes and sizes and forms, a great range of different types.
Yeah, and I think we didn't really know too much about the small dinosaurs until recently, and thanks to some amazing finds coming out of China in particular, we're learning about dinosaurs that were not much bigger than a crow in that size range, and we are actually learning about the colors of dinosaurs. In the past 2 weeks, a couple of announcements have been made where scientists have been able to discern the colors of at least a couple of feathered dinosaurs, which is the first time anyone's been able to do that.
Mm-hmm. So many questions I could ask, and, you know, they're all kind of little kid questions, but maybe I'll just ask you one, and I'm sure that this is the kind of things, one of the first things people do ask. Why is it that we had so many dinosaurs that were so big? I think, you know, in terms of megafauna, on land megafauna, I guess whales is a different thing, it's the biggest thing we've ever had.
Yeah, and sometimes people forget just how big dinosaurs were. You know, an elephant weighs a few tons. The biggest dinosaurs weighed potentially between 50 and 100 tons. Mm. And the largest carnivores on land today are things like a Kodiak bear, which weighs in at something like 800 kilograms. T-Rex, the largest carnivore ever to walk on land, was about 5,000 kilograms. So it's a scale that is far beyond anything we know today. And the reason for that is still kind of a mystery. It's one of the things which I think, to some extent, still remains unsolved. And I address it in the book, and I think it has something to do with their metabolism, that they were neither cold-blooded in the sense of reptiles or warm-blooded in the sense of birds and mammals, but maybe had a metabolism that was in between, and that may have allowed them to achieve gigantic proportions. Elephants have a tough time getting big just because they have to eat so much. They spend most of their waking hours eating just to keep their furnaces stoked. So that may be one of the reasons they got so big. But certainly there was a tremendous diversity of giant animals. Most groups of dinosaurs spun off descendants that grew to huge proportions.
Yeah. Well, that's you touch on there something that I guess has been a controversy within dinosaur paleontology for some time, and maybe it's yet an unresolved question. That big question being, were dinosaurs warm-blooded or cold-blooded?
Yeah, and I think that it is definitely still a mystery. There's still lots of debate. There, the two sides are fairly entrenched, and they both think that they have strong evidence in their favor. The argument that I make in the book is that they may both be right, in the sense that dinosaurs were probably not cold-blooded like lizards, nor warm-blooded like mammals, and I think the evidence against both of those is pretty good. But they may have had something that was sort of intermediate. And there is growing evidence that that's the case. And there have been scientists who've been saying this for a number of years, but I think the evidence is mounting in that direction. And I think we may actually get this particular item resolved, I think, in the next 5 years or so. That's my hope.
Mm-hmm. Well, people have been aware of dinosaurs for some time. And although there's, I think, been a big change in how people think of them and what their environment was like and their place in the environment, and going from, and perhaps it, it has to do with the change away from thinking that dinosaurs were essentially big tropical lizards to a more nuanced kind of appreciation for them and learning more, and also then thinking more about what the world that they lived in was like.
Yeah, I think a lot of this came down to one scientist and one discovery, which is an unusual thing. But there was a revolution or a renaissance in our understanding of dinosaurs. When I grew up, dinosaurs were those sluggish, dim-witted, sprawl-legged lizards, basically, that were sort of staggering around these ancient landscapes, roaring at each other, and not very interesting, dull-looking. And then all of a sudden, in the 1970s, they were reinvented. And when they were supercharged. They were sprinting around the landscapes, T-Rex running at jeep-chasing speeds and things like that. And a lot of these dinosaurs came up out of the swamps, and their legs were put underneath their bodies instead of being sprawled like lizards. And this came down to a discovery by a Yale paleontologist named John Ostrom, who discovered one of the first raptor-like dinosaurs, one of these small meat-eaters like Velociraptor. And he noted that this animal had little in common with lizards and a lot in common with birds. And that included a number of bony features, but also included the ability probably to run fast. And he then argued that birds may have been the direct descendants of dinosaurs, an argument which has since been strongly upheld by the dinosaur community to the point where we can say today that dinosaurs didn't go extinct. That there are more dinosaurs around today than there are mammals. There's about 10,000 living species of birds, and birds, in a very real sense, are dinosaurs themselves. So we now think of dinosaurs as being much more bird-like, more intelligent, more complicated in their behavior, looking after their young, living in herds, and colorful, potentially, anyway, much more so than we had before. And so dinosaurs are much more interesting now than they were just a few decades ago.
Yeah. But just to pick up on that point, because as you say, just recently I think there's been something new in development in this area that in the past when we tried to do reconstructions and we were making guesses of what dinosaurs looked like, I guess again we were thinking of them as big lizards or big reptiles, and so they were always kind of green. Now though we have reason to believe that perhaps there was a lot more color there than we had been thinking before, but then that gets at this question, well, since we don't have a lot of dinosaur skin, we really don't know. I mean, how do you approach that question, which is a big but a basic question, what color were they?
Yeah, we actually do have a number of specimens that preserve the skin of dinosaurs. Most of my field research now is concentrated in southern Utah in a place called Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. And we've been, over the past decade, we've been taking out skeletons of duck-billed dinosaurs and horned dinosaurs and things like that. And a number of these specimens have skin preserved, or they have the impressions of skin preserved. But they don't, to date, have color. So we don't know the color based on skin for any dinosaur. But as mentioned, there are these amazing discoveries just announced in the past few weeks where researchers have found specific cells or particles inside the fossilized feathers of certain small dinosaurs, and these things are called melanosomes, and they've allowed these researchers to determine the colors of at least two dinosaurs. One is called Anchiornis, and it's now been reconstructed with these stripes on the tail and sort of a reddish-brown hue to the most of the feathers. So this is exciting because for the first time we can actually stick color in a dinosaur, and it's not surprising perhaps that they were colored like birds, but that still leaves us completely in the dark with dinosaurs like T-Rex and Triceratops. My guess is that like mammals, they probably ran the gamut between camouflage and sort of bright coloration depending on where they lived. Did they live in the open? Did they live in the forest, etc.? And I don't know that that's a question that we'll ever get to. Having said that, we didn't think 5 years ago that we would ever get to the topic of color even in feathered dinosaurs. So new technologies and very smart people combined to sort of allow us to address questions that are intractable at earlier times.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's that maybe says something interesting about science and the way that it works. And I don't know that people always really appreciate the fact that that they may have this idea that, well, you know, how science goes, it sort of creeps along. And sort of steadily over time, you learn a little bit more and you learn a little bit more. And then maybe one day you say, well, based on what we've learned recently, we need to do a little bit of a reassessment. But it does happen that occasionally something comes along and it's just a sort of a mind-blowing piece of new data or new way of looking at things that really turns the field upside down. And that does happen in science, too.
It does, but I think even beyond that, there are these revolutions that happen, like the one I mentioned with John Ostrom at Yale, where a discovery triggered a rethinking of the whole group. But even beyond that, I think there's this illusion that we've pretty much figured out all there is to know about not just dinosaurs, but most areas of science. And the truth is really the opposite. We've just begun to scratch the surface of what nature has to offer us. And just to give one example, in the past 25 years, we've discovered more new kinds of dinosaurs than in all prior history. And that rate of discovery shows no sign of abating. So there will be plenty of new dinosaurs for kids to discover that are growing up right now thinking that they want to be paleontologists. And this applies not just to paleontology, but to most areas of basic research and science. There's always new and exciting things to be done.
Why is that we have just in this relatively recent past been finding all these new dinosaurs?
I think there's more people out there looking, and we're going to places that people have never looked before. So, for example, I've done a fair amount of work on the island of Madagascar. Prior to our team going there in the 1990s, nobody had really done significant research over extended periods there excavating animals. And so every single thing we find is new. I've worked in South Africa and Zimbabwe and Mexico. And, I mean, even in Utah, virtually every dinosaur that we can identify right now in southern Utah is brand new to science. But we're working in an area that people haven't gone before. Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument was the last large area in the lower 48 states to be mapped because everyone just went around it. Indigenous peoples, pioneers, everyone just walked around Grand Staircase. And now it represents one of the last untapped treasure troves of fossils. But today there's still just a handful of roads going into this area, and that means we have to do a lot of walking up and down hills, and we have to get helicopters to help us carry the fossils out because otherwise there's no way to move them. So I think it's a matter of more people looking in areas that haven't been explored before.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Scott Sampson, is a dinosaur paleontologist, an evolutionary biologist, and educator. He serves as research curator at the Utah Museum of Natural History and adjunct associate professor in the Department of Geology and Geophysics at University of Utah. He now makes his home in the San Francisco Bay Area, where he continues dinosaur research and is very much involved in writing and consulting projects involving education reform and sustainability. And as I mentioned, he's involved with the PBS children's program Dinosaur Train, very popular show about dinosaurs. It runs on our station, and so you can look for that and or wherever it is you watch your children's TV shows. I also do want to mention that you marked this for folks who are listening around Chicago and who are dinosaur fans. You marked this in your calendar. He'll be visiting the Field Museum in Chicago in May, on May 29th, where they're going to be celebrating the 10th anniversary of the arrival of Sue, the T-Rex. that they have up there. So he'll be there, and he'll be doing a book signing. So if you're in and around Chicago, you can look for him there and meet him. And, of course, if you would like to learn more about dinosaurs, you can look for his book, Dinosaur Odyssey, Fossil Threads in the Web of Life. It's published by University of California Press, and you can find it in the bookstore. Questions, welcome, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you may also send your questions by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about dinosaurs and their place in the ecosystem of the time, and again how that is changing. I still sort of find myself thinking about the popular images of dinosaurs that we got when we were kids, that they lived in swampy, jungly kind of environments, that's really not the story, or maybe that's a tiny part of the story.
Yeah, I think our understanding of the ecology of dinosaurs has changed dramatically, and we now think about them as being sort of akin to mammals in the sense that you find mammals basically from pole to pole and through all kinds of different, environments, deserts, rainforests, whatever. And the same is probably true of dinosaurs. There were no rainforests when the dinosaurs were around. There were no grasslands. There was no tundra, as far as we know. In fact, the biomes, the types of vegetative communities that were around, we're really not sure about. But we do know that dinosaurs were pretty much everywhere. They appeared when all the continents were united as one giant supercontinent called Pangaea. Pangaea broke apart into Gondwana and Laurasia and then continued to break apart into the continents we recognize today. Dinosaurs first appeared in the Triassic when Pangaea existed, and therefore, as all the continents broke up into these little separate land masses of rafts, the dinosaurs on board just went along for the ride and evolved in their own independent directions, which is why we find dinosaurs in Australia, in the Arctic, in the Antarctic, and all these other different places. The Mesozoic was a hothouse world. There was global warming that far exceeds the direst predictions of the present day. As a result, there were no polar ice caps to speak of for most of the age of dinosaurs, and that means that sea levels were a lot higher. You take all that water and ice that's tied in ice and you stick it into the oceans, sea levels go up, and sea levels went up enough not only to flood some of the coastline areas, but to literally flood the middles of continents. And so for much of the Mesozoic, continents like North America were flooded in their central portions, and the same is true of Africa and South America. Europe was an archipelago of islands for a while. And it looks like there may have been more dinosaurs in the temperate regions than in the tropics, which is the reverse of what we see today. We tend to see more animals in the tropical regions, fewer in the temperate regions. And that may have been because it was simply too hot down the tropics. But that's an idea that still has yet to be really tested. But dinosaurs, we can say with confidence, did live in deserts. They did live in very wet coastal climates. The whole range of climates that were around, dinosaurs were probably there.
Mm-hmm. I think that's curious, again, I guess, going back to the image of the dinosaur in popular culture, that you would say someplace would actually be too hot for a dinosaur to live.
Absolutely. I think that may well have been the case, particularly if you're big. I mean, elephants really struggle to dump their body heat, and it's one of the reasons they have big ears that they wave around and they spend a bunch of time in the water. Being big is tough. You tend to hold on to body heat the larger you are, and so these giant dinosaurs would have really struggled in very hot climates, very likely.
All right. We have a caller here. We'll bring him in, and that's somebody on our line number one. They're in Urbana. Hello.
Hello. I have two questions. The first is about our modern dinosaurs, the birds. What is current thinking? Did they develop from a relatively small, perhaps a single species or a single genus? Or do they probably come from less closely related species?
All right. You said you had multiple questions, but let me take that one first. birds, as far as we know, evolved from some kind of small feathered theropod dinosaurs. And theropods include all the big carnivores and all the small carnivores of dinosaurs, but they also include some weird animals that were probably omnivorous, eating plants and meat, and maybe even herbivorous, just eating plants. So if you want to think about the closest relative to birds, probably think about Velociraptor, which was not did not look the way Steven Spielberg portrayed it in Jurassic Park. It was closer to 3 feet tall than 6 feet tall and was heavily feathered, as in birds. And it turns out that a number of dinosaurs were feathered, that is, non-bird dinosaurs were feathered. Some even likely even lived in trees and things like that, and we would have had a hard time telling them apart from birds. But the birds that we know today likely evolved from some small feathered, maybe meat-eating dinosaur that lived on the order of 160 million years ago in the Jurassic.
Thank you. The other question has to do with the topic of were dinosaurs warm or cold-blooded or perhaps an intermediate form. And I'm interested in their possibly distant relative, the mammals. Were the early mammals, which existed at the same time, probably warm-blooded, cold-blooded, or did they go through a process of intermediate form?
Yeah, so that's a great question. Mammals were around the entire time dinosaurs were. So it's often thought that the dinosaurs disappeared and then the mammals took off. But the dinosaurs first appear on the order of 230 million years ago, and that's about the same time that mammals appear, in the late Triassic. It's very likely that the first mammals were warm-blooded. The term that scientists like to use is endothermic. They keep a constant body temperature, and it's one of the things that allowed them to be small. And for the entire age of dinosaurs, mammals didn't get much bigger than, you know, probably cat-sized for the most part. There's a few that may have exceeded that, but most of them were like shrews, very small, sort of in the shadows of the dinosaurs. And we don't know exactly why that's the case, why they didn't evolve to bigger sizes. Some people think that dinosaurs basically kept them small because they occupied all the big-bodied niches. But in terms of their metabolism, we do think that mammals did have most of those early mammals did have a warm-blooded metabolism like modern mammals do today.
Well, thank you.
All right, thanks. Just to underscore that point, because I think it's an interesting one that, again, this probably goes back to the images in popular culture we have of dinosaurs, but I'm sure that people think of the world of the dinosaurs as being a world populated exclusively by dinosaurs, but that there were, in fact, mammals living alongside the dinosaurs, and maybe not, you know, all of the mammals that we would expect now and we see now, but in fact that they were there side by side.
In fact, if you were to go back to the age of dinosaurs, especially if you go back to the last period of the age in the Cretaceous, if you happened to be walking around and you didn't see any dinosaurs, you might not think it looked that alien. I mean, there were fishes, lizards, turtles, crocodiles, frogs. There were flowering plants everywhere, insects all over the place, including bees and butterflies. So it would have looked probably fairly familiar to us. It's just that you'd have to keep your eye out for those big T-Rexes wandering around.
Yeah. Let's talk next with someone in Rankin. This is line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Hi, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a question for you. If you can talk about the changes in the concepts of fossilization. You had mentioned, is it the melanosome in the feather material?
Right. So it's a really interesting question. When I grew up, the sort of party line was that fossils were made of rock that had completely replaced the original bony material. And therefore, there really wasn't anything from the original animal left in a fossil. It was just sort of a faithful representation of what the bones look like. That turns out to be wrong. And thanks to a whole bunch of interesting technologies that allow us to probe the bones further, we can now say that many fossils include some of the original material, in particular, the original mineral material in the bones. But there's been some amazing studies that have come out in the last 15 years or so. Many of them have been made by a woman named Mary Schweitzer in North Carolina, and she has found even genetic material, basically, inside dinosaurs, and there's cells looking potentially blood cells. And so there's a number of features that are preserved, and now we're finding these feathers and skin impressions. Some people claim they have impressions of organs, etc. So we are able to get structures out of dinosaurs that we really didn't know were there. Another field that's just taken off that's related to this is histology, looking at the microstructure of bones. And so there are paleontologists that spend their time slicing bones up into these very thin slices you can see through, and then looking at the structure. And from this, they've been able to tell how fast dinosaurs grow up, how long dinosaurs lived, so many things about their life histories that we really just didn't know before.
I'm so glad you brought up all these topics, because I could not remember Mary Schweitzer's name. The topic of, like, blood or genetic material is another thing that I tied into your topic of melanosomes. That would indicate that you're able to look at this stuff at, like, the molecular chemistry level, or at least like a subcellular level. How would that material get preserved in these samples?
Yeah, now I'm not a biochemist, so I'm probably not the best person to ask that question, but I can tell you that we really, as I said before, we had no clue about this. And it does turn out that this material is degraded, but there's ways to reconstruct parts of it.
Oh.
We haven't found anything like a genetic sequence that would allow us to clone a dinosaur. What we have found is genetic material. We've been able to see that it reacts more closely with the genetic material of birds, for example, so we can show that affinity with modern birds. But we don't have the kinds of intact information that people might like us to have to be able to make some other stretches in technology.
Great. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Thank you
for the call. We're talking this morning with Scott Sampson. He's a dinosaur paleontologist. He's also an educator. He is the author of a newly published book, Dinosaur Odyssey, Fossil Threads in the Web of Life. And he is a consultant and host of the program Dinosaur Train that runs on PBS. And I did mention that we have it on our station. And I just wanted to be clear on this, because I did not give complete information. It, in fact, is on every day on WILL-TV, Monday through Friday. The program is on at 8:30 in the morning, and then on both Saturday and Sunday, it's on at 7:30. So lots of opportunities to see Dinosaur Train, which I am told is a very popular show. So you can look for it there, and again, go out to the bookstore if you'd like to read more on dinosaurs. Look for the book, Dinosaur Odyssey. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Over to Bloomington, Indiana for another caller here, line one. Hello.
Hi, I have another couple of questions about the evolution of dinosaurs to birds. Let me ask, you have said that the dinosaurs were not necessarily completely cold-blooded, but cold-bloodedness would have a survival advantage, wouldn't it, because cold-blooded animals require much less food, and birds must have a lot of food. It takes a lot of energy to fly.
Yeah, so the metabolism problem is an interesting one. Most animals on the planet are cold-blooded. Their temperature varies over the course of the day, depending on exposure to the warmth of the sun, etc. And it is a much more fuel-efficient technique, shall we say, or strategy of running your life. Being warm-blooded or endothermic is a lot tougher, and you have to eat a lot more. So a lion has to eat every few days in general, whereas a similarly sized crocodile can go weeks and potentially even months between meals, because the lion is warm-blooded and the crocodile is cold-blooded. So we can think of cold-bloodedness as being sort of the fuel-efficient Toyota Priuses, and the warm-bloodedness as being like the fuel-inefficient, you know, four-wheel drives. But having said that, obviously there's some advantages to being warm-blooded. For example, if you have a constant body temperature, you can be active 24 hours a day, which gives you an advantage over your competitors that can't be active at night, for example. So, yes, there would be some advantages to being cold-blooded, but warm-bloodedness also has its benefits. And the evidence at this point suggests that dinosaurs were like on their growth rates, how fast they grew, everything else suggests that dinosaurs were not cold-blooded, and that certainly the ancestors of birds weren't. And my bias that I express in the book is that those dinosaurs that led to the evolution of birds may have been warm-blooded already. One of the things that feathers do is help you retain heat. And why would you need to retain heat if you're not producing much of it? Us warm-blooded folks generate lots of heat all the time. And the reason to retain it potentially is if you get small, really small, you want to hold on to your heat to stay warm. But it also helps you to keep your eggs warm. And we've actually found dinosaurs, feathered dinosaurs, sitting on nests. They've actually died in position sitting on nests looking after their eggs. And so this is another bit of evidence that's been used to suggest that at least those particular dinosaurs may have moved up the metabolic spectrum towards true warm-bloodedness. So this is a debate that's ongoing. If you speak to 10 dinosaur paleontologists, you'll get probably at least three or four different kinds of opinions. But that's where I stand on it right now.
Well, in order for a dinosaur to evolve into a bird, even if you ignore the huge modifications, respiration, muscle structure, just the ordinary muscle structure of front legs will not power wings. You gotta have a huge modification. Even if we ignore those modifications, the dinosaur had to sacrifice the efficient use of his front legs while those front legs were evolving into wings. And you know, when you combine these considerations with the fact that every step in the evolutionary process has got to produce a survival advantage. If you don't have a survival advantage in every step, evolution stops. So how do you force dinosaurs to lose the effective use of their front legs long before they can fly? And also, they need much more food long before they can fly. So how did dinosaurs evolve into birds, with each step in that evolution producing a survival advantage?
Well, evolutionary biologists are fairly confident that all life on Earth can be traced back to single-celled ancestors, which means that life has gone through some major transformations. And you're absolutely correct. At every step of the way, every stage had to be adapted to living in its environment, whatever that environment was, or it just wouldn't have persisted. So the same is true for dinosaurs. A lot of these feathered dinosaurs, other than birds, no dinosaurs, as far as we know, were actually flapping flyers. There's some that may have had wings that were gliding, but none were flapping flyers. However, adding feathers to your front limb doesn't necessarily make those limbs inefficient or incapable of doing their thing. Velociraptor and all of its, raptor-like kin would have had feathered arms that would have been very good at hunting and doing all the things that their ancestors without feathers may have done. And so for every step in the process that we see, we can actually argue that, yes, they would have been entirely efficient at doing what they needed to do at that particular time. So feathers evolved first, not for flight, but potentially for controlling body temperature, potentially for display, and later they were co-opted or used secondarily to actually help the animals be airborne, maybe in gliding, and then after that were co-opted into something like flight. But by the time they were getting into flight, they may have been living mostly in trees where they didn't need to run around on the ground, and they could have been gliding to catch small prey, etc. So I think that there's still lots of great evidence to show that every step along the way would have been adaptive.
I need to jump in here. I want to thank the caller. We just have about 10 minutes left, and I got some other callers here to continue our conversation with Scott Sampson. We're talking about dinosaurs, and if you'd like to read more, you can look for his book, Dinosaur Odyssey, Fossil Threads and the Web of Life. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next, someone on a cell phone calling from somewhere near Effingham, line 2. Hello.
Hey, Scott. Good to talk to you.
Hey there.
Hey, congratulations on a dinosaur train. As a grandfather of a little boy, I'm very familiar with that.
Thank you.
Good combination of two of a little boy's favorite things, dinosaurs and trains.
Right.
I just got to ask you, you were talking about the comparison of the environment back in the dinosaur days versus today. What's your opinion on the possibility of something still being around? You hear the rumors of sightings and, we're still finding fish that we thought were extinct. What do you think about that? I'll hang up and listen.
All right. Great question. There's all kinds of cryptic animals that are postulated around today, and the Loch Ness Monster, for example, and people still wonder about dinosaurs showing up in the tropics of Africa or something. My guess is that that will never happen. Other than birds, and we're still discovering birds, new birds all the time, so in that sense we're still discovering dinosaurs, but the idea that we might go into a jungle one day and find T-Rex or even something smaller is very unlikely, and it's unlikely for a few reasons. One, people have been pretty much everywhere at this point, and so the chance of finding something, especially on land, which is much better explored than the ocean, is small. But two, we have no fossil record, so that means that for the last 65 million years, we have lots of fossils of different kinds of animals, but they don't include these dinosaurs other than birds. And if they really had been around all that time, we would expect to find their fossils.
Okay. I hope, that, again, that answers the question. I think we have somebody else here, line number three. We'll go on there. Yes, hello. Go ahead.
Hi. I haven't been able to listen to a good part of your program, but I just heard the comment about the evolution having to produce adaptive things that are positively adaptive. But mutations are random, and some things are going to happen that aren't necessarily adaptive at the time. Some things might even be negative and cause the expiration of some critters. You think about in human beings alone, it's more than 50% of the pregnancies that happen, the fetuses don't survive. And presumably part of it, what's happening there is mutations that cause death during development in the uterus. Some happen, cause death later on. Excuse me. We see evolution happening now in things, it's much more obvious in things that produce pretty rapidly, like bacteria and viruses. We notice the things that evolve that happen to thwart our efforts at protecting ourselves, like using antibiotics, or we see things happening in farm fields. There are weeds that have adapted to the use of Roundup because we've used Roundup Ready genes in some plant materials, and we've encouraged the evolution of plants that are adapted to protecting themselves against Roundup. But during that process, there probably were things that have popped up that couldn't survive. So I just wanted to point that out. That's my interpretation, my understanding of how evolution works.
Well, it's very true that mutations with respect to the survival of the animal are random. However, natural selection preferentially selects the organisms that are most fit to survive. And your insect example is a great one. We put these toxins on our plants to try and kill off the pests, so to speak, and a portion of the population has resistance to that pesticide, and the ones that don't die out because they're not adapted to it, and then the ones that can resist it survive and spread, and then we have to come up with new pesticides. So, yes, there are mutations can be random, but that doesn't mean that at every stage the animal doesn't have to be adaptive. It does. Otherwise, there's just too much competition out there, and there's too many things that are looking to eat something or, you know, avoid being eaten. So all animals at all stages, and plants for that matter, need to be adapted to their environment, and they are.
Again, I want to thank the caller. We're coming down to our last 5-6 minutes. And this, again, gets me back to a question that I wanted to raise again, and we talked a little bit about all the remarkable forms, the different forms of the dinosaurs. And you just have to ask, because there are so many strange, bizarre, baroque shapes. I think just one thing, for example, that you're kind of interested in and you deal with is horns, various kinds of horny structures on the animals' heads. And you just have to wonder, well, why? What was that about? Why should all of these things have happened, have come about? Do they serve some purpose? How do you explain that?
Right. So dinosaurs, as I mentioned, were not only big but very bizarre in some cases. And it was long thought that these horns and crests and hooks and spikes and all these various bony bells and whistles were for fighting off predators, that they were weapons. Mm. But it turns out that a lot of these things would have been lousy weapons. They're hooks that curve over the nose like a can opener that could never have been used as a weapon. Or a lot of these crests are very thin as a millimeter or two, and therefore would have not resisted the bite of a tyrannosaur or something like that. So they don't make good weapons. So then people thought, well, maybe they were used to help control the body temperature. You could put blood into them, and they'd help the animal cool off. But the problem with a lot of these ideas is that every single species of dinosaur that has these features tends to be different from all its close relatives. So if you had these structures because they serve some function like fighting off predators or controlling your body temperature, you'd expect evolution to settle on one or a few designs and stick with them. What we see is the opposite, rampant variation with every species being different. And if we look to the modern world, we see the same thing. There's lots of horned animals or animals with horn-like structures, everything from deer and antelope to chameleons, even ants. There's lots of creatures that have horns, and they use these things first and foremost not for beating up on predators, but for getting mates. Charles Darwin recognized that in addition to natural selection, which selects for animals to survive, there was something that he called sexual selection, which selects for animals to pass on genes to the next generation. So a peacock may have these amazing feathers that help it attract a mate, but it also helps it get picked off by predators, so it doesn't help it survive. And it looks like dinosaurs had a lot of these same kinds of things. All of these horns and crests may have had a lot to do with attracting members of the opposite sex and establishing rivalries with members of the same sex.
All right. Just to go back to another thing, there are lots of different things we could talk about, but there's a chapter here specifically that's kind of about dinosaur diet. And I think that that's, again, and when you think about the popular conceptions of dinosaurs, we were taught when we were kids that, well, there are plant eaters, there are herbivores, and then there are carnivores, and we think of the big carnivores like T-Rex, and that the carnivores eat the herbivores. And I'm sure that's a vast oversimplification of how it is that, what the nutritional strategies of these animals was.
Well, in some ways it's fairly accurate. If you look at most mammals today, for example, most are either plant eaters or meat eaters. There's a number, like bears and like us, that eat both plants and meat, but usually there's a strategy for one or the other, and the same is probably almost certainly true of most dinosaurs, and we think we're fairly confident in separating those out based on teeth and other types of structures. But I think increasingly we're starting to look at the possibility of omnivore dinosaurs that may have had plants and meat, and we're looking at features of their skeleton, we're trying to look for gut contents, the actual fossilized remains of their last meals, to tell us about what they ate. But we're still a long ways off from actually correlating an animal with its diet. We're not even sure what plants were around in many cases. And what we can say is that, for example, the flowering plants that make up 90% of or more of the plants alive today were not even around until the last period of the dinosaur era, the Cretaceous. So it was only in the Cretaceous that flowering plants showed up, and the plant-eating dinosaurs must have had a fairly significant impact on the evolution of those animals. So one of the most important points I like to make is that we often think about the extinction of the dinosaurs opening the door for mammals to take off, and it's because they died out that we're here. And to a trivial extent, that's true, but it ignores the fact that dinosaurs co-evolved with all of the plants and the insects and the other big-bodied animals that were around at their time. So we have not just the death of the dinosaurs to thank, but the lives of the dinosaurs, because evolution constantly influences all components of the community, of an ecological community all the time.
All right. Let's talk with someone else on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Speaking of evolving, I heard years ago that the Geological Survey took some core samples of the Earth and noted that the oxygen content at the time that they feel the dinosaurs existed was something like 35 or so percent. And it seems now, according to a current analysis, we're something in the range of 20%. So the dinosaurs had a much richer oxygen content that they existed in, and so forth, that contributed to all the other things that we know about them. So volcanic ashes and everything blocking the sun's rays and other things like that have caused diminution in the temperatures and cooling and all kinds of things have occurred, but the oxygen content is significant in view of the fact that we're talking about climate change and other things. And but you can go so long without food, you can go so long without water, but just think of how long you can go without good air. Thank you.
Yeah, the differences in the climate are significant. There was much more carbon dioxide, CO2, in the atmosphere for most of the age of dinosaurs, which contributed to the global warming. The oxygen levels, from what we can tell, went up and down, as they have since the dinosaurs were here. I'm not sure about the study that you're citing. The figure that you said of over 30% sounds very high to me. If you put too much oxygen in the atmosphere, it actually oxidizes in the sense that it ignites, and the atmosphere can literally go on fire. So oxygen is an amazing thing in that it stayed within very narrow limits since life first produced oxygen and stuck it into the atmosphere in the first place billions of years ago. And so it stayed within fairly narrow limits, but within those limits it has gone up and down, and that has no doubt influenced all of the organisms that are air breathers.
We have just a couple of minutes left, and I do want to talk about one of the questions that preoccupies non-scientists and I think probably frustrates scientists, at least based on what you read here, and that is the subject of dinosaur extinction. And you make note of one in particular, one paleontologist who said he got so tired about being asked about that, he finally said, look, I don't care. Well, I don't really care so much how they died. What I really want to know is how they lived. And if you're a dinosaur scientist, I'm sure that's right. But that for the non-dinosaur people, that is one of the things that seems to be a preoccupation. And of course, also, you did say on the subject of extinction, you said, well, they actually didn't go extinct in a way because we have birds. What can we say, though, about what really happened and why it is that there are so many dinosaurs that seem to be a kind of evolutionary dead end?
Well, a couple of things there. Everything is an evolutionary dead end. 99.9% of all species that have ever existed on planet Earth are now gone. So all things go away at some point. Dinosaurs were around for 160 million years. Humankind has been around for about 200,000. So we're not even scratching the surface in terms of the dinosaur success. Second thing there is that the dinosaurs didn't all go extinct at once because they didn't all live at the same time. Over the three time periods that they were around, the Triassic, the Jurassic, and the Cretaceous, there were different dinosaurs in every time period and even every part of those time periods. So what happened at the end of the Cretaceous about 65.5 million years ago is that the last dinosaurs, other than birds, went extinct. As to why, a lot of people still think there was a giant asteroid about 10 kilometers across that slammed into the Gulf of Mexico and threw up a huge cloud of gas and dust and choked out the sunlight and therefore caused the plants to die, etc. But there's also volcanism in India and things like that. I think that the final chapter has yet to be written on the death of the dinosaurs.
And there we're going to have to leave it. This is an encore presentation of a Focus 580 program we first broadcast on February 11th, a conversation with Scott Sampson. His book is Dinosaur Odyssey. And I do want to mention again that he's going to be at the Field Museum on May 9th. So if you're in the Chicago area, you'd like to see him. They're going to be celebrating the arrival of their T-Rex, Sue. A lot of past programs are available on our website. Just go to will.illinois.edu. WILO programs made possible with support from Lincoln Square. Starting as one of the nation's first enclosed malls, Lincoln Square is now evolved into a mixed-use lifestyle center. Information on business space and future development projects available at 217-367-4092. We are WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. We'll break at this point for an update on the markets and news. Stay tuned.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Rebecca King in Galesburg at 309-341-5007. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the commodity markets, where at the Chicago Board of Trade, we see May wheat at 495, up 8. July is at 507, up 3 1/4. It's at 507 3/4. It's also up 8. Kansas City July wheat 511.5 up 6. September 519.5 up 2.25. May corn 370.25 up 3.5. July 381 up 3.25. September not trading in the pits. December 399.5 up 2.75. May beans 954 up 9. July 961.5 up 8.75. November at 931. They're up 5. May soybean meal, 265.30, up 3.80. May soybean oils, 39.48, up 11. April live cattle, 95.95, up 47.